Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The title of this talk is Does God Exist? How Do I Know? My goal is to actually get through all the five ways in summary form to sort of whet your appetite, and I think this will make for a good question and answer discussion at the end. So I have my text in front of me to cover the ground. The question as to whether or not God exists is not just a philosophical question with a long history and much commentary. It is a question that wells up within each human heart. For some students, looking at the amount of literature and disagreement on this subject can be daunting and discouraging because there does not seem to be a consensus. Yet it remains for each person to live according to some answer to the question, does God exist? For some, it is a matter of faith, and so one lives according to some source of revelation, the person of Jesus Christ, the scriptures, the Quran for Muslims, or other claims to divine revelation. For agnostics and atheists, the question remains unanswered, or one has a reasoned argument to the negative. Yet the result to such an answer leads one to the haunting proposal in Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov. If there is no God, anything is permitted. Taking up the task of reasoning to God's existence has tremendous implications for each person, regardless if he or she will ultimately settle the matter for others. This is why I believe Thomas Aquinas's five ways or five proofs for God's existence continue to be studied. They change people's lives. I was raised Catholic and always believed in God, but in college I encountered people who didn't share this belief and offered a lot of counter-arguments. When I understood Aquinas' arguments, I experienced deeper understanding of my own faith, and I gained a greater confidence in it. So Bishop Robert Barron, who has greatly impacted the church and American culture through his ministry at Word on Fire, often remarks about his freshman year at Bishop Fenwick High School, a Dominican high school in Chicago. He came in one day, and there his Dominican teacher had put on the board the five ways. And he says it was a launching point for his own vocation and his engagement in the intellectual tradition of the church. I have a friend and former coworker who studied at in New York City. She said her chief goal in life was to make as much money as possible. And she was an atheist until she took a philosophy course and encountered Aquinas' five ways. And there she discovered five arguments that she couldn't readily dismiss. So she set about to prove Aquinas wrong. And what ended up happening was she was convinced of God's existence, and now she is in a Dominican monastery. She's a Dominican nun and one of my sisters in the order. So needless to say, what we are going to study together in this lecture can have a tremendous impact, whether it shores up your faith or deepens your understanding. Perhaps it can totally change your outlook on reality and open you up to the possibility that God loves you and is revealing himself to you. Now, that last part certainly takes another step. I'm not going to get there tonight. Before stepping into the text of Aquinas and evaluating his arguments for God's existence, a few clarifications are important. So we have, for the five ways, five clarifications. First, the five ways are attempting to prove a God exists. This means that Aquinas is not setting too high of a bar for himself. He's not attempting to prove that the Christian God exists, namely the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He's also not attempting to prove that the God that exists is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving. His goal is to show that a God exists. So he gives a definition in each of the five ways as to what is a God. Second, Aquinas respects your intelligence because he does not think that the existence of God is self-evident. What God is remains a mystery to us, and it is only through the course of learned reasoning that one can gain assurance that God exists. Such a process requires training and keen observation, which means that only those experienced in philosophy can know by reason and answer in the affirmative that God exists. For those of you wanting to engage your peers who may be atheists or agnostics, it's important to keep this point in mind. Aquinas respects their intelligence. Don't try to put forward arguments from self-evidence. Third, the five ways are not arguments that progress according to the principles of the natural sciences. Aquinas does not use physics, cosmology, or biology to reason to the existence of a God's existence. Right? Rather, he uses the sciences of natural philosophy and metaphysics. In fact, the five ways appear in the Summa Theologiae, which is a text Aquinas composed for Dominican friars who are beginning their theological studies. His students already would have been trained in the liberal arts and years of philosophy. So we must keep in mind that Aquinas is moving quickly through the arguments and using technical philosophical language. One of my brothers was saying, it's kind of like he's a street artist, you know, sort of painting a caricature. He's moving very quick. I think you'll feel that tonight. So again, this is an important clarification to keep in mind if you think it's possible to readily dismiss what Aquinas is saying. Fourth, the five ways are not the only ways. Many years ago, a priest in training remarked that to me that he didn't think the five ways could possibly be helpful because, after all, why would you need five? Right? He's kind of missing the point. It's not a lot of great reasoning. The five arguments we'll explore all take a different starting point in reality, something observable to us. And from that point, we begin to see like a whole array that beckons to a cause. Like we see effects, we're reasoning to a cause of those effects. And so as varied and as much of an array of different effects there are in reality, there are ways to reason to God. And that's kind of the point. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., we're gonna cover what I think is one of the sharpest arguments Aquinas has. It comes from his philosophical treatise on being in essence, or De Ente in Essentia in Latin. So it'll be 9 a.m. tomorrow at the Newman Center. So we can explore beyond the five. Fifth point of clarification. This is for all the Catholics in the room who may find this lecture daunting and a bit confusing. We can know by faith that we can know God exists by reason. A little strange. So the First Vatican Council, in its dogmatic constitution, Dei Filius, states that it is a matter of the faith that man can know God by reason. Right? So if you believe in the true teaching of the church, you can know by faith that it's possible to know that God exists by reason, even if you don't experience that tonight, which I hope you do. Okay, so this is also kind of a clarification of what's contained in Scripture. So Romans 1:20, Aquinas loves this. I love it as well. It states this: ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. Right? Visible attributes communicating to us invisible attributes, from the visible to the invisible. Also, Book of Wisdom, all Dominicans love the Book of Wisdom. So Wisdom 13:9 states, for if they so far succeeded in knowledge that they could speculate about the world, how did they not more quickly find its Lord? So it's a kind of more poetic but veiled statement to the same fact. By speculating on the world, we can reason to God. So if at the end of this lecture, again, these five ways remain opaque, believe it's possible. And continue to come back and join us 9 a.m. tomorrow. Maybe it'll be a breakthrough. Okay. Also, set up to the five ways. I'll just leave that up. Great resource, Aquinas 101. We have a whole course on the five ways. You can go there and see nice little black and white and red illustrations to kind of help you get through this. Okay, so here's my setup to the five ways. In the article preceding his proofs for God's existence, Aquinas establishes that the possibility of providing establishes that there is a possibility of providing a legitimate argument. This is an important step because we cannot know God's essence, and so our only access to his existence is through a posteriori argumentation. This means that he intends to reason to the existence of a cause according to the presence of certain effects. You can kind of think of this as like a detective, right? He comes to the crime scene, he sees effects of a cause, and he tries to reason to what the cause is, who the culprit is of the crime. Okay, that's a posteriori argumentation. The start of each of these arguments has a definition presupposed by the presence of some effect, which is to say that the same definition of God is not used in each of the five proofs. I've alluded to that a little bit already. Later in his work, he will show that the conclusion of the five ways is in fact one God. But you'll have to go to question 3 of the Summa Theologiae to get there. That's where he talks about how God is, and he talks about God's simplicity, that he's one. Okay, so each of the five ways will begin with a major premise that X is what we call a God. After establishing the definition, he then moves to his minor premise, some being is a X. The minor premise is where the real argument is taking place, where Aquinas puts the burden of proof on himself to show that some effects within the known universe require the existence of some being that is X. He concludes that a being that is X is what we call God. Again, this is not establishing the Trinity or the important properties of the Christian Judeo notion of God, or I shouldn't say notion there, I should just say Christian Judean God, but that some being that we call a God under certain criteria exists, right? That's his claim. That's what he's getting at in each of the five ways. To summarize the five ways, we can say that the first way, I think I have another slide for this, the first way is a proof according to motion, showing that an unmoved mover exists. The second way argues from efficient causality, to show that a first cause that is uncaused exists. The third way argues from the contingency of existent things. He uses language of possible and necessity. We'll get into that later. And so he shows that there must be some being that exists through itself or has its necessity through itself. The fourth way argues according to the existence of grades of perfection. And it concludes that there is a maximum being that is the cause of gradation in goodness, truth, nobility, and the like. That is to say, maximally good, maximally true, maximally noble. Lastly, the fifth way argues according to teleology, and it concludes, so that's a technical term meaning let's study of ends or movement to ends or goals, a certain like order within creation. And it concludes that there must be an intelligent cause that orders sub-rational beings toward their particular end. That's your pets. That's your plants. That's your rocks. Sub-rational. Okay. There's going to be a lot of text. I really want you to just get Aquinas' language. I'm going to read this to you. So the first way, this is question 2, article 3, in the prima pars of the Summa Theologiae. Here's what Aquinas says. The first and more manifest way is the argument for motion. It is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion. Now, whatever is in motion is put in motion by another. For nothing can be in motion except as it is in potentiality to that towards which it is in motion. Whereas a thing moves inasmuch as it is in act. For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality. But nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality. Thus, that which is actually hot, as fire, makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it. Keyword, changes it. Now, it is not possible that the same thing should at once be in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot, but it is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing should be both mover and moved, that is, that it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is in motion must be put in motion by another. If that by which it is put in motion be itself put in motion, then this also must needs be put in motion by another, and that by another again. But this cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently, no other mover. Seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are put in motion by the first mover, as the staff moves only because it is put in motion by the hand. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover put in motion by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. Okay, the first way is a little bit longer. That's a lot of text, and we probably don't understand what he's talking about when he says potentiality, actuality, motion. So hopefully I can make that a little bit clear. So here's a quick summary. Aquinas begins with a rather curious claim that the argument from motion is more manifest or clearer to us. The reason it is more manifest or clearer does not have to do with its reasoning or conclusion, for all the proofs result in a demonstration. So all the five ways are certain about their conclusions. Rather, the starting point of the argument that there is motion in the world is more evident to our embodied experience. We experience that things are in motion, or that change exists, right? You look out, things change. Squirrels come and go, they get small, they eat that, they move about. There's change in the world. Things are one way, then they become another. That's very evident to us. To elaborate, the example Aquinas gives about motion, which is a technical term for change, he states that fire changes wood from cold to hot. We don't just know that by abstract conception. We feel that, right? The wood set on fire moves from cold to hot. Other examples, your skin is changed from pale to tanned by the light of the sun, or if it's like mine, a little bit pink, right? You get a little burnt. Your shoes change from being smooth and clean, like these guys, to rough and dirty by you wearing them. We experience that something changes other things in this world. And Aquinas describes this change as moving from potency to act. That is to say, a being or things move from having the possibility to be in a certain way to actually be in that certain way. Right? Cold wood has the potential to be the hot wood. And it can move, or actually it is moved, from that potentiality to actuality by the fire. So the wood is moved by another mover. Okay, from this evident account of change, Aquinas continues his argument by citing a principle that an object that is a mover and moved cannot be the source of its own change. There has to be another that moves or changes it. This suggests a series by which A is moved by B, B is moved by C, C is moved by D, and so on. The series of changes and changeable agents of change cannot go on to infinity, or that would be absurd. Unlike the ticking on, the ticking on of days or the counting up to infinity, the series here is different. You could always have another day, you could always count higher, but to have a series of motions that doesn't have an unchanged agent or change of change or a unmoved mover is impossible. It's comparable to having a series of train cars where one's tugging on the other one, and you can think like, oh, there can always be more in between. But unless there's an engine that isn't moved as the other train cars, but actually is propelling them forward, the movement, the motion doesn't happen. There's something qualitatively different about that mover. Okay. To summarize, Aquinas points out that change exists in nature whereby things move from potency to act by some agent or mover, some external cause to the thing. There can be a series of moved movers, but this cannot go on indefinitely. This shows that something exists which is not reduced from potency to act when moving another being from potency to act. It's important to note that this mover is not remote and in the past, not like just some big bang explosion that then sets everything in order. Rather, this unmoved mover is necessary for the change that exists here and now. The unmoved mover is giving actuality and change to the visible reality we see here and now. Without that unmoved mover, it's like the train cars that can't move without the engine. This unmoved mover, which enables the change we experience in reality, is what we call a God. That's the conclusion. Okay. So the second way, this is along the lines of efficient causality. So Aquinas' text yet again. The second way is from the nature of efficient cause. In the world of sense, we find there is an order of efficient causes. This is no case known, neither is it indeed possible, in which a thing is found to be the efficient cause of itself. For so it would be prior to itself, which is impossible. So there's this similar train of thought here to the thing that moves itself. Now, in efficient causes, it is not possible to go on to infinity, because in all efficient causes following in order, the first is the cause of the intermediate cause, and the intermediate is the cause of the ultimate cause, whether the intermediate cause be several or only one. By ultimate cause, he means like the final effect, right? Now, to take away the cause is to take away the effect. No cause, no effect. Therefore, if there be no first cause among efficient causes, there will be no ultimate nor any intermediate cause. But if in efficient causes it is possible to go on to infinity, there will be no first efficient cause, neither will there be an ultimate effect nor any intermediate efficient causes, all of which is plainly false. We see that efficient causality exists in the world. Therefore, it is necessary to admit a first efficient cause to which everyone gives the name of God. Okay, let's try to move through this one. Much like the first way of motion, the second way begins with reference to sense experience, so what you take in by your five senses. Aquinas doesn't state that the second way is the most manifest, as he does the first, but he nevertheless points to our experience of reality to highlight an observable order. This order is one of efficient causality, in which we notice that one thing causes other things to be in a certain way. At first glance, this may seem to be the same thing as motion coming from a mover, but the nature of causation and change are different aspects, albeit with a subtle distinction between them. We might say that change suggests a principle of causation, but it's only in looking at the species of causation that we come to understand something about the change. Another explanation as to why Aquinas doesn't combine the first two ways into one comes from a 20th century Thomist, Etienne Gilson. He suggests that the first way shows that the change we experience requires present and active, unmoved mover. But the second way seeks to explain why anything exists at all here and now. So it could be the difference between looking at change and alteration in the world on the one hand, according to the first way, and then on the other hand, looking at existence in the world, existence itself, not just change and alteration, but being. But what is a cause? We can define it as that from which something else proceeds with a dependence in being. A cause is that from which something else proceeds with a dependence in being. A cause is a principle from which some being proceeds and has an intrinsic connection with it. Right? It exists as it is because of the cause, and without the cause, it wouldn't exist in that way. To understand the cause of something is to give some explanation as to why it is the way it is, or from whence it came. Now, there are four different species of causes that Aquinas enumerates, taking them from Aristotle. And hopefully I listed them. I did not list them. You'll have to listen attentively. Okay, the four species of causation. There is the material cause, there is the formal cause, there is the efficient cause, and there is the final cause. I'll do my best to explain here. When we consider human artifacts, like statues, we can begin to understand the difference and connection of these causes. For one thing has four causes that explain why it is the way it is. Now, when I say existing things in matter have four causes, okay? So, a statue can be any number of representations. Before I get to the representations, it can be made out of any number of materials. You can have a statue out of marble, you can have a statue out of wood, you can have a statue out of bronze, right? So the material itself explains why the statue is the way it is. Well, it's a marble statue, it's a wooden statue, right? But that doesn't explain all of it, right? Because it can be any number of representations. It can be a horse, a gargoyle, it could be David. The shape or appearance of the statue proceeds from its formal cause. So we have a material cause, we have a formal cause for the same statue. The final cause of the statue is that for which it was made for. The final cause explains what's it for the sake of. This is like the why, you know, it's like the inner teenager. Like, why is it that way? Like, why should I care? You want to know the final cause. What is this getting at? So the final cause explains, like, what's the statue for? Is it to, is it for propaganda? Is it to glorify God? Is it to educate the masses? Is it to just simply have beauty that one can appreciate and enjoy? The efficient cause, which is the one relevant to the second way, is the sculptor. Right? The statue is not going to, the material is not going to receive the form. The final cause isn't going to get there unless something makes it, somebody makes it, right? So the efficient cause makes the material to receive the form and directs that reception of the form to the final cause. So this is the efficient. There's a certain power at work in efficient causality. The statue is brought into being by an efficient cause, and it is therefore an effect of the cause. By looking at the statue as an effect, we intuitively recognize that it did not bring itself to be what it is. Right? Something else explains its existence. We presume that some sculptor has made the statue, and it's a logical fallacy to suggest that the statue or any effect can be its own cause. The statue would have to be and not to be in two different respects in order to cause itself to be or to become what it is. So this is ultimately violating the principle of non-contradiction. If you walk away with nothing else tonight than this principle, you'll be all right. The principle of non-contradiction, which is the basis of all knowledge, states that nothing can be and not be at the same time in the same respect. This grounds all language. This grounds our understanding of reality itself. Nothing can be and not be at the same time in the same respect. To disagree with that is to sort of confirm it, right? It's an apophatic state. I'm losing my Greek terms, but it's true in the speaking of it. Its truth is just so manifest. Okay, so this principle, this is important to consider because Aquinas does not say that all things have a cause. Some objectors to the second way want to say, well, Aquinas is claiming all things have a cause. No, it's not what he's saying. He's saying that nothing can cause itself to be. And an effect has a connection to a cause. His conclusion to the second way is important because it states that there exists an uncaused cause that we call God. So moving from statues to visible reality, we can see that things come to be or are altered by other causes. Often, we see a series of intermediate causes. Fathers and mothers cause their children to be, and yet they are caused to be from their parents. The series is evident in the sun causing heat and energy in the ecosystem, and we can say gravity causes the sun to be what it is. For all these effects to be the causes of other effects, they must first exist. They must have being. This existence, the possibility for a series of causality, cannot proceed from something dependent upon another for its own existence, for its own being. There must be some uncaused cause that makes possible the order of efficient causality evident to our senses. That uncaused cause is what Aquinas calls God, according to the second way. Okay, less pictures, more text. Here we go, third way. The third way is taken from possibility and necessity and runs thus. We find in nature things that are possible to be and not to be, since they are found to be generated and to corrupt, and consequently, they are possible to be and to not be. But it is impossible for these always to exist, for that which is possible not to be at some time is not. Therefore, if everything is possible not to be, then at one time there could have been nothing in existence. Now, if this were true, even now there would be nothing in existence, because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing. Therefore, if at one time nothing was in existence, it would have been impossible for anything to have begun to exist. And thus, even now, nothing would be in existence, which is absurd. Therefore, not all beings are merely possible, but there must exist something the existence of which is necessary. But every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by another or not. Now, it is impossible to go on to infinity in necessary things which have their necessity caused by another, as has already been proved in regard to efficient causes. Therefore, we cannot but postulate the existence of some being having of itself its own necessity, and not receiving it from another, but rather causing in others their necessity. This all men speak of as God. Okay, some technical language in there. It's worth noting that at the start of this explanation, that the third way has challenged many scholars of Aquinas to give an account of his argument. There are arguments related to this one, which you can find in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 1, Chapter 15, and also in Book 2, Chapter 15 of the same work, right? And then what we're going to treat tomorrow in the seminar, Chapter 4 of De Ente et Essentia, we're going to look at another argument. Some want to sort of read into this. Okay, so When Aquinas refers to possible beings, he's referring to things that actually exist, but that also come into being and pass out of being, right? So he's not talking about, like, in an alternate universe, this thing could exist, or something in your imagination that it's possible for it to exist. He's talking about concrete reality. That thing there, your cat, you know, your plant, that's a possible being. Okay, so a dog exists, but we fully expect the dog to cease to be. Looking at trees and plants and so forth, even humans to a certain extent, when we apprehend them, we know of a time when they were not and expect a time when they will cease to be. Possible beings suffer generation, coming to be, and corruption, coming out of being, which means they come to be in time and they cease to be in time. The term necessary, technical term, so we have possible, now we have necessary. A necessary being does not refer to a being that must here and now exist, or that we couldn't think of an alternate universe in which it would exist. The term refers to a type of being that is permanent and doesn't suffer generation and corruption. Such beings are not readily apparent to us, but the idea of necessary being existed in the thought of Aristotle and Aquinas. So he thought the celestial bodies, the stars, were thought to have a permanent existence that didn't come to be and cease to be like possible beings. So when Aquinas refers to necessary being, he's not yet referring to God, but he's referring to beings that do not come to be in time nor cease to be in time. Now we can follow his argument, which I have on good authority as an argument from natural philosophy, similar to that which you find in Aquinas' commentary on Aristotle's De Coelo. So that'd be the assistant director, Father Ambrose Little, who's working on an article that I'm gonna keep prodding him to publish. But so he says that. As noted, possible beings come to be in time. Otherwise, they would be necessary beings. With this explicit connection in mind, Aquinas states that if there were only possible beings, that is to say, there were no necessary beings, there would need be a time when no possible beings existed, right? Because it belongs to the possible being to come into being in time. That scenario results in a time when nothing existed. And if that is the logical, like, conclusion as to what happens if there's only possible beings, then you're having to deal with the question of nothing somehow generating possible beings. It would not be possible for there to be possible beings without an external cause. Because how could nothing generate itself into a type of fragile existence? There has to be something with a capacity to bring about that. Yet when we look around and we realize that something does indeed exist rather than not exist, which is to say we see possible beings, we realize that this line of thinking doesn't work out, it's absurd. And so Aquinas says, therefore, there has to be necessary beings that undergird the existence of possible beings. But he's not done yet. There's another step, because we have to account for the existence of necessary beings. If a necessary being has its existence from another, we must give an account or explanation for the existence of that second or prior necessary being. And here we're going into a similar sequence, right? Where B causes A, and C causes B, and D causes C. In order for there to be a sufficient explanation for the existence of the series, there has to be a necessary being that is different in kind. That is to say, it doesn't have its existence from an external cause. This reasoning appeals to the same reasoning found in the second way, that it is not possible to have an infinite series of causes. There must need be a first cause in the second way, but in the third way, we are dealing with a series of necessary beings that have their being from an external cause. The solution is that there must be a necessary being that has its necessity or permanence through itself. Not as a cause, but simply through itself. As opposed to being yet another reference to an external cause. This necessary being that has its existence through itself is what we call a God. Okay. The fourth way. Pictures are back up there. Great. That means there's less text. Okay. The fourth way is taken from the gradation to be found in things. Among beings, there are some more and some less, good, true, noble, and the like. But more and less are predicated of different things according as they resemble in their different ways something which is the maximum. As a thing is said to be hotter, according as it is more nearly resembles that which is hottest. So that there is something which is truest, something best, something noblest, and consequently, something which is uttermost being. For those things that are greatest in truth are greatest in being, as it is written in the book of the Metaphysics, chapter 2. Now, the maximum in any genus is the cause of all in that genus. As fire, which is the maximum heat, is the cause of all hot things. Therefore, there must also be something which is to all beings the cause of their being goodness and every other perfection. In this we call God. Okay, so there's Aquinas' reasoning. The fourth way is kind of wild. Now, some kind of want to say it's about exemplar causality. Others are thinking he's kind of going a Platonist route, but it's not. There's a lot you can read on this, and you can find some talks on the Thomistic Institute podcast on the fourth way as well. Just 45 minutes on the fourth way. It's a wild thing. Okay. The fourth way can be often confused with Platonist notions of separate forms, which suggests that anything that exists in the visible universe is participating in some separate ideal and perfect form that is not visible. So all horses participate in like the horse form, squirrels the squirrel form, humans the human form. So Aquinas has Platonic ideas in his work, but he's not a Platonist. He's not falling into this trap. He does not appeal to that metaphysical framework of separate forms. He begins with what we see in visible reality, what's more immediate to us. And there we see that things can be said to be more or less in some property. For example, we readily make comparisons with regard to brightness, length, height, depth, and other sensible properties. The reason we can say something is brighter, longer, higher, deeper than another thing is because we sense within a group that one is brightest, or longest, highest, and deepest. The maximum, the one most perfect in the property, establishes the possibility for gradation, for this comparison of more or less. It's not even necessary that the maximum be absolute, but simply that it be the current maximum of a genus. So you can see this example or observation doesn't appeal to abstract forms. It's rooted in concrete reality, concrete experience. Yet Aquinas does not make reference to the properties I just listed, which have more to do with like the accident of quantity, or kind of a, which is a bodily existence. Instead, he makes reference to the good, the true, the noble, and the like, which are ways of speaking about being itself. For Aquinas, insofar as something exists, it is good, it is true, it is noble, and there's a few other transcendentals as well. By the very fact it has existence, it is these things, right? It's being, it's goodness, it's convertible. Okay, so this is what he's getting at in the fourth way. We can see that there is a gradation among these things. We can say that food is good, but the sun has more goodness because without the sun, we would have no food or other things we need for existence. The good of the sun extends to more that is in reality. Right? You can see it's more prior, it's more desirable. So it has a greater good. Also, we can say the same with regard to truth. For a being is true insofar as it is intelligible, and things vary in their intelligibility. So I'm not talking about the intelligence in between individuals, but to say some things have more to be known about it than other things, or things that we know extend to more of reality. So I'll try to explain this. Okay. Now, beings are more or less intelligible the more they are not subject to change and are relevant to more of reality itself. The more a being is immaterial, the more universal is its intelligibility. For example, the truth of mathematics, which is the study of being, not in motion, but in matter, it's a kind of more universal science, that truth of that science is greater than, say, the truth of fashion, which isn't even considered a science. It's something kind of fickle. It's very subject to change. You may, if you spend time thinking about it, find certain continuous properties about proportions, but you'd be hard-pressed. I see a lot of stuff that violates those notions of properties. It just seems to kind of change and go, right? So the fact that it changes and goes, it has less truth. If we consider nobility, we should not think of it in terms of what society esteems, but rather nobility as a perfection of being. A plant is more perfect and noble than a rock because it has the power of life and reproduction. In a certain sense, greater perfection there. Following this line of thinking, an animal is more perfect than a plant in that it has not just the power of life, but also sense life and freedom of movement. Humans are more perfect and noble than animals because we have rational life. We can know, we can love. So you can see that there is a gradation of good, true, and noble in beings. We can observe the gradation of good, true, and noble within visible reality, and we can reason that there must be a maximum that is their cause. Aquinas establishes a metaphysical principle at the end of his first paragraph that gives us further insight to where he's going. That which is greatest in truth is greatest in being. But what does it mean to be the greatest in being? Something has more or less being based upon its dependence on another for its being. Remember the distinction between possible and necessary being, or beings. Some beings come into existence and go out of existence, and in this way, they have less being than those that are permanent and incorruptible. Yet, that which has the greatest being does not have existence that comes and goes, nor does it have an existence dependent upon anything other than itself. The same being is also the maximum in the gradation of degrees of good, true, and noble, and it is therefore the cause of all beings that have degrees of the good, true, and noble. That cause is what Aquinas calls a god. So there's a lot more to be asked and said, and that has been said on the fourth way. Some Thomists, like I was saying at the beginning, want to bring in efficient causality, of such a cause bring in discussion about the efficient causality of such a cause pointing to Aquinas' reference to fire being the cause of heat in things, right? We think of heat doing something, acting, almost like the sculptor on the marble. Others like to make reference to exemplar causality, which is a type of formal causality that establishes the perfection of the form. So you can think of an exemplar as like the blueprint in the mind of the architect that the building's coming to be more in likeness to. In some ways, I've given you an interpretation of this argument that is more modest. You know, I think Aquinas is just saying this gradation suggests a certain uttermost being. How do we understand that? Has its being not from another, but through itself. But suffice it to say, we have to move on to the fifth and final way. We will finish the talk tonight. Okay. The fifth way is taken from the governance of the world. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always or nearly always in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence, it is plain that not fortuitously, but designedly, do they achieve their end. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. The fifth way begins by referencing that there is some governance of the world. Aquinas sees that the world is intelligible. We can study it, know it, and make inferences about it because there is a consistent behavior, pattern, and tendencies in natural bodies that lack intelligence. Heavy objects consistently fall toward the strongest gravitational force that's near them, like the Earth, right? If I drop this, not gonna drop it, it's probably expensive, but you anticipate where it's going. If it didn't go to the ground, you'd say, whoa, why? Because it acts for its end. It's consistent in falling to, in the medieval understanding, it goes to its love, the center of the universe, desires it. So animals also, right? Animals feed, raise young, avoid predators in consistent ways that ensure its species' survival, provided there's no intervening illness. Right, some animals that get an illness, they start doing some pretty wild stuff, right? But there's an intervening cause there. Otherwise, they tend to act in a certain consistent pattern for the best result. Even our study of light, particles, and the like show that certain things are very good at consistently behaving in a way natural to that thing. Aquinas refers to this behavior as acting for an end. Teleology is the notion that things act for an end. It's a study of this. You, as a rational animal, act for an end called happiness. It's what you're after. And it's how you ultimately explain the series of choices you've made that have led you to this talk tonight or to this university. You ultimately want to be happy. That's the end you seek. You also can direct things within the world toward particular ends, like in Aquinas' example of shooting the arrow at the target. The arrow won't move toward the target on its own without your intention and skill and execution. You have to draw the bow, you have to aim it, you have to release it, you have to shoot it. Aquinas suggests that such as the arrow, he suggests that just as the arrow has no capacity to fly toward a target on its own, the rest of reality would not have an ability to act for an end or consistently be and act according to its nature and the laws of nature unless there were some intelligence that established the teleology within the reality. This isn't to suggest that God directly acts upon the behavior of natural bodies as you and I would act upon the arrow or like a marionette puppet. But it is to say that in some way he causes the existence of the teleology or that which he is governing. Although Aquinas appeals here to intelligent governing of the world, he's not falling into what some call an intelligent design theory or argument. Intelligent design arguments focus on particular phenomena that demonstrate a beautifully complex network of parts. The existence of such complexity, the argument puts forward, can not be the result of chance or inherent principles within nature, such as evolution. This argument goes on to claim that such complexity requires an external intelligence to design it and to cause it to function. Aquinas, however, does not appeal to the complexity of physical systems. He rather appeals to the order found within nature, especially the observable realities that are quite familiar to us. The fifth way appeals to the natural order of the universe that is not a cacophony of chaos, even if certain events result from chance, because the underlying order of things remains consistent such that we can understand and know them. The intelligence by whom the universe has its laws of nature and order is what Aquinas calls a God. So there I've kind of passed through in a quick fashion the five ways, and you can probably see why not too many people do this. It's a lot to get through, and I haven't even touched some of the disagreement that exists within them, but I'm hopeful that maybe this led you to some understanding of what Aquinas is getting at here, and maybe you see that there is something higher that exists here, and you have that by reason. Now, again, it doesn't go as far as we like it to go. Knowledge of the Trinity, of the Incarnation, of the Word of God and Jesus Christ, these are only gifts of faith, and in fact, we should relish that. It's a wonderful thing to receive knowledge from God in a personal, intimate way. But there's still more that reason can do. Aquinas, further on in the Summa, basically questions 3 through 11, is going to start to speak about how God is. As I mentioned before, question 3 talks about simplicity. He's also going to get at God's perfection, his goodness, his truth, the divine names, right? So there's sort of a modest goal, I think, in this sort of street portrait approach of question 2. But nevertheless, we can see that there is a God that exists according to five ways here and now. And hopefully, if you're not too tired of my voice, we can explore a sixth way tomorrow at the seminar from the De Ente et Essentia, when we look at the real distinction of essence and existence and how we can think of a God who is his own existence. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.